Welcome to 40ANM N5, a download of 40ANM LLC, recorded at 2200 Eastern on Sunday, July 14th. I'm Chris Bohm, and today we are coming to you from Moscow, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, Facebook launches its new graph search application. The ups and downs of targeted ads and how some dedicated retailers rapidly implement changes based upon valuable lessons. France announces significant changes to its Hadoopi law and online anti-piracy strategies. Updates to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, go into effect in the U.S. Parts of Vancouver, Canada are slated to get 2 gigabit internet services. And the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board holds its first public hearing in Washington, D.C. And finally, a small but dedicated ISP in Utah strives to maintain what it sees as a standard for Fourth Amendment protections of digital rights in an era of needed surveillance. But first, Facebook has begun rolling out Graph Search, a new search tool that will allow users to quickly gather information from across the site. For Facebook users, the general concept of the news feed was simple. An algorithm showed you content that it believed that you would find interesting based upon your activity on the site. With Graph Search, Facebook would argue that they are making it easier to find information that's useful and relevant to you by looking not only at your own search activity, but also by incorporating recommendations via your friends. For instance, researching friends that have gone to London on vacation would bring up all friends in your network who have either listed London as somewhere they have visited in their timeline, or have checked in from a location in that city. You would also find publicly uploaded images, as well as images of the city uploaded to your site by your friends. You could also use Graph Search to find friends who speak a specific language, look for pictures that include you or a friend, or just search for photos that you have liked in the past. If Facebook can't provide its own answer, it will list results from the internet. However, some have asked, do you really want friends to be able to search through everything that you have liked from around the web? Facebook has anticipated this and several other privacy-related questions. In December, Facebook released a blog post entitled Better Controls for Managing Your Content. This post accompanied a new set of tools launched to make it apparently easier for users to control where their information appears across the site. As of Monday, July 8th, the new Graph Search feature is available to Facebook users who have their preference language set to U.S. English. And this new application will be watched closely as it rolls out and is used in the coming months. With the launch of Graph Search, several online journals in the past week have made available stories that they have done in recent past on the intersection of technology, law, and privacy preferences. One such story, by Forbes staff writer Kashmir Hill, reported on a New York Times piece from 2012 on targeted advertising done by none other than Target. It is well known that every time you go shopping, particularly with a store loyalty card, you share details about your purchasing patterns with retailers. Many of these retailers are studying those details to figure out what it is that you like, what you need, and for instance, which coupons are most likely to make you happy as a customer. As Forbes discussed, Target statistician Andrew Pohl had worked on a model for the store chain that assigns every customer a guest ID number tied to their credit card name or email address, which stores information on purchases they've made, along with demographic information that the store has collected or bought from other sources. In analyzing this data, some useful patterns emerge to the retailer. For instance, many shoppers purchase soap and cotton balls. But when someone suddenly starts buying lots of scent-free soap, coupled with extra big bags of cotton balls, in addition to hand sanitizers and washcloths, the statistics have shown the high likelihood that the customer may be getting close to a pregnancy delivery date. About 25 products were identified that, when taken together, allowed Mr. Pohl to assign each shopper a pregnancy prediction score. The score could also help in estimating a due date within a small window so that the store could send relevant customers coupons corresponding to different stages of pregnancy. As Forbes highlighted, perhaps it's a boy based upon the color of a rug purchased. The opportunities for potential analysis here could be myriad. There was one early unintended consequence, however. in that one irritated parent from Minneapolis, Minnesota, felt the need to complain to his local Target store that his teenage daughter was receiving pregnancy-related coupons from the chain. The manager of the store apologized, as reported by Forbes, and then followed up with an apology and a phone call some days later. On that call, the manager would learn that the targeted ads resulted in a discussion at home, which revealed that the daughter was in fact pregnant. Target had discovered fairly quickly that, when made so obvious that Target knew about their pregnancy, in the words of the Forbes reporter, it creeped people out. Further, if the customer might have simply been buying materials for someone else, the targeted advertising could be wrong about the individual receiving the ads altogether, with embarrassing or even worse consequences. Target's answer to the conundrum was rapid and sound. They began bundling the baby-related product advertisements in their materials with other completely unrelated ads, alongside lawnmowers, wine glasses, and the like. Thus, it still got the prospectively right ads to the potentially right customer, but also did not, in the words of the Forbes reporter, creep the customer out, or worse, put the customer off the chain due to what, at its core, might have been a decent idea for the customer's benefit. What Target learned and what other retailers are learning, if attentive to their brand reputation in the context of targeted advertising, is that even when something may be perfectly legal and statistically possible, is it the right thing to do? Or even if it may be the right thing to do, at its core, is there a right way and a wrong way to do it? If a customer does benefit from and want to receive ads targeted to something so potentially sensitive as a pregnancy, is it the kiss of death for the retailer for the customer to know so inelegantly obviously that they are being targeted? Perhaps yes. France last week announced that the long-controversial Hadopi law, which could potentially disconnect the internet services of suspected copyright infringers, has been withdrawn and replaced with a system of automatic fines. Under Hadopi, which was promoted early on by the entertainment industry, particularly Fnac in France, users identified as possible copyright infringers online were sent the first of two written warnings. In what is termed in the industry as a graduated response, succeeding notices, with different ramifications, would also then be sent if the user ignored the first. The ultimate penalty could have been disconnection of their internet service and placement of the user on a blacklist. Hadopi had been introduced in 2009 by then-President Nicolas Sarkozy, but the law and the Hadopi organization that it created to carry out the notices and warnings was immediately and significantly stymied by the French Constitutional Court, which declared that access to the internet was, under French law, a basic human right. Several reviews of the law and re-reviews by the court ensued, but ultimately, after the government had spent millions on the agency that patrols the system during its implementation, it only ever used its ultimate authority once, fining one individual €150 and disconnecting their internet service for a period of 15 days. The most recent report accompanying Hadopi's end describes that instead of disconnecting users, those suspected of piracy could be fined if they don't reply to the warnings, with a relatively low fine of €60 to begin, and the size of the fines would increase based upon the number of infractions. French anti-piracy is now poised to focus, in the report's words, on commercial piracy and sites that profit from pirated material rather than on doling out very heavy punishments to individual users. A much-needed update to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA for short, went into effect beginning July 1st. Under the new rules, websites catering to children will no longer be able to collect a range of identifying information without obtaining verifiable parental consent first. Although many are in agreement that the rules required a much-needed facelift to bring them into the current internet age, some argue that the costs related to implementation of the new rules have not taken into account shifts in online advertising or the effect of the new regulations on startups. COPPA will now hold the owners of sites and apps frequented by children responsible for third-party services as well, such as plugins or ads, that collect personal information from visitors who say that they're younger than 13. Third-party services will only be held liable by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission if the FTC can prove that the services knowingly collected personal information from children. The FTC estimates annual compliance costs for web services at roughly $6,250, and new services at roughly $18,600. However, roughly 85 to 90% of the relevant services are run by small businesses. At a recent forum hosted in Washington, D.C., by the nonpartisan think tank Tech Freedom, President Baron Zucker believes that the revised rules could have unintended impacts on startups, making it far less likely that, from the largest to smallest app and site developers, there will be less of an impetus to develop services properly designed for children. As a concern over growth in deceptive online advertising targeted at kids began to grow in the 1990s, Congress passed COPPA to spur parental engagement and attempt to protect the security of personally identifiable information of children collected online. Close consideration will be given in the coming months to how the new rules are implemented and the potential impacts. In Vancouver, British Columbia, a startup called 1Gigabit is now going a bit further than its name might suggest. Having been launched to compete against Shaw, a Canadian ISP that already offers gigabit internet speeds in parts of Vancouver, Edmonton, and Alberta, Ars Technica reports that 1Gigabit has announced a 2Gigabit offering. Shaw reportedly now offers gigabit speeds to small parts of Vancouver and 250 megabit per second downstream service to other parts of the city for approximately $115 per month. 1Gigabit, according to Ars Technica's reporting of a CBC article, is offering to charge $45 to $65 per month with a limited availability rollout, mostly to apartment and condominium complexes. To be frank, the company's founder told the CBC, it's uneconomical to serve single-client premises given the construction costs that are involved to run fiber. Launched on June 24th, 1Gigabit aims to serve the majority of MDUs, or multiple dwelling units, in Vancouver within 20 kilometers of downtown. The ability to serve and install the MDUs is a result, in part, to advances in technology of the fiber, allowing it to be bent and generally less sensitive to capacity loss when using the same installation methods in buildings as with regular copper lines. The U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board held its first public meeting this past Tuesday, July 9th, in Washington, D.C., a seven-hour session chaired by David Medin, a former partner in the WilmerHale law firm and Federal Trade Commission attorney now confirmed as chair of the PCLOB. According to Mr. Medin, the focus of the meeting was very precise, to determine what improvements should occur to surveillance programs that presently operate under U.S. law, pursuant to Section 215 of the U.S. Patriot Act and Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Altering how the FISA court operates is one of several suggestions that deserve serious consideration, said David Medin in an interview reported after the hearing by Bloomberg. In order to connect the dots, we need the broadest segment of metadata, said Stephen Bradbury, the former head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel under President Bush, speaking of the data retained for purposes of the NSA's PRISM program. But Jamil Jaffer, lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union, called the NSA programs a massive dragnet that is both unwise and unconstitutional. He also accused the Bush and Obama administrations of having misled the public about the scope of surveillance under anti-terrorist programs. The USA Patriot Act authorized the FBI and NSA to gather records that are relevant to an authorized investigation, which, according to Mr. Jaffer, was supposed to be a limit on what was gathered. Instead, he said, the government has taken a view that it should have all phone records because someday some of it may prove useful to investigation. It can't be the case that everyone's phone records are relevant to investigations, which makes the bulk collection of telephone records illegal, added an attorney for the Center for Democracy and Technology. Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies, warned the panel of the rise of a system of secret law being made by the FISA court, a court which operates behind closed doors. Retired federal judge James Robertson, a former member of the FISA court, said that he came away from his experience deeply impressed with the judges and their commitment to protecting Americans from unreasonable searches. But he said the panel is one-sided, and that is not a good thing. A judge needs to hear both sides of any case, and at present, he said, there is no one in the process to object. He urged the panel to recommend a change that would allow someone or some group to argue against expanded surveillance requests. Otherwise, the judges effectively operate not as judges, but merely as agency managers. Robertson served on the court from 2002 to 2005, but told the Associated Press that he left the court over concerns about surveillance. James Baker, who served in the Justice Department and represented the government before the FISA court from 1998 to 2007, said having an adversarial check in place could slow down much-needed surveillance approvals. Public participation in the session, however, included no representatives from industry, an absence which was notable given that much of the discussion centered around what role those firms should play in surveillance programs, according to the International Association of Privacy Professionals. There was some discussion as to whether private industry should be made to keep important data, say, for 5 years under a new data retention requirement. Although Sharon Bradford Franklin, senior counsel at the Constitution Project, commented that a data retention law would not only open up possibilities for the use of data by government, but also could increase the likelihood of its possible misuse by private industry. Two other recommendations included requiring the FISA court to declassify portions of its work and establishing tougher legal standards for the government to meet before it allowed to collect information involving the communication of U.S. citizens. "We had a range of recommendations on all sides that have given us a lot of things to think about," David Medin said after the meeting. Mr. Medin also acknowledged the lack of private industry participation in the meeting, but said that the PCLOB is very much interested in their input and welcomed not only industry input, but also public comment in this area until August 1st, the comment deadline. "We are going to continue to review the FISA court opinions, and we're going to continue to get briefed from the government so that we can better understand the details of these programs," as reported by Bloomberg. Mr. Medin said that the panel intends to release a report with recommendations on the NSA programs. The other members of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board include retired Judge Patricia Wald, former Bush administration attorney Rachel Brand, who is now a lawyer for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, James X. Dempsey, vice president of the Center for Democracy and Technology, and Elizabeth Collins Cook, former assistant attorney general at the Justice Department. X Mission, Utah's first and oldest internet service provider, has, according to the Guardian newspaper, spent the last 15 years defending customer privacy against government surveillance requests in a way that larger rivals appear to have not. Since 1998, according to The Guardian, X-Mission founder and CEO Pete Ashdown has rejected dozens of law enforcement requests, including Department of Justice subpoenas, on the grounds that they violated both the U.S. Constitution and Utah state law. "I would tell them," Mr. Ashdown said to The Guardian, "please just send us a warrant, and law enforcement would simply then just drop the request rather than follow through." Mr. Ashdown told The Guardian that he assented just once, on his lawyer's advice, to a 2010 FBI request backed by a warrant from the FISA court. "I believe that under the Fourth Amendment, digital data is protected," Mr. Ashdown said to The Guardian, "and I'm not an unpaid branch of government law enforcement." But he remains worried about Silicon Valley's carefully worded insistence that the government has no direct access to servers. "Access to network, not servers, is the key," he said. The Utah State Attorney General has reportedly called X-Mission soft on crime, but the company, Mr. Ashdown says, with 45 employees and turnover of roughly $7 million per year, has suffered no measurable retaliation to business. In the wake of NSA revelations, Mr. Ashdown has made public a report on the requests he has received and the responses that the company has made. You have been listening to 40ANM in 5, a production of 40ANM LLC. For more information, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's podcast were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the Associated Press, Bloomberg, The Guardian newspaper, Ars Technica, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and the Los Angeles Times. We will be back with you on Monday, July 22nd. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.